to political problem-solving. The puzzle of public policy-making, when public policy isn't needed, spurs a politician to find a more complicated puzzle solution. America is much richer than it was in 1970. Our per capita gross domestic product, in constant $2,000, was $18,391 40 years ago and $38,262 in 2008. Therefore, obviously, we require fewer federal subsidy programs. Requirements, as you may have noticed, play no part in politics. In 1970, there were 1,019 federal subsidy programs. In 2008, there were 1,804. The Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence has been lobbying politically for tougher firearms purchase and registration laws for a quarter of a century. The Brady Campaign rates states according to how tough those laws are. In 2008, Utah, Alaska, and North Dakota were involved in a tie for 43rd place. California was rated number one. New Jersey was rated number two. The number of murders committed with firearms in California in 2008, 1,487. The number in New Jersey, 236. Utah, 19. Alaska, 13. North Dakota, 0. Considering the number of reasons there are for shooting people, I'd say Alaska, Utah, and North Dakota need more and cheaper guns. Lest you think that the political business of brewing trouble, no matter the lack of ingredients, happens only in America's oddball political system, I give you a December 20th, 2009 New York Times story about our sister democracy, France. A French woman posted an online comment about France's Secretary of State, Nadine Morano, calling Morano a liar. The pun-worthy Morano subpoenaed the Frenchwoman's internet protocol address, discovered her identity, and sued her for public insult toward a member of the ministry, an offense punishable by a fine of up to $18,000. In response to the Frenchwoman's protest at her treatment, Jean-François Copé, the parliamentary head of France's ruling party, the bowlishly named Union for a Popular Movement, said, "The Internet is a danger for democracy." How to cope with the likes of Copé, the people of California seem to know, the Brady campaign be damned. The best politicians can be victims of their own moral overreaching, even if they avoid the pitfalls of reform ideology and the other pits that politicians fall into. But individual politicians are, after all, individuals like the rest of us, and should be judged individually. It would be wrong, very tempting, but wrong, to think of them all as simply bastards, although the occasion for temptation is so great that if we had to make a general rule about politicians, we should probably give in to the tempting. In fact, Hazen Pingree, Tom Johnson, Samuel M. Golden Rule Jones, and Fiorello LaGuardia were good mayors for their time and place. Ronald Reagan was a good enough president. Margaret Thatcher was a good enough prime minister. Mikhail Gorbachev himself, by Russian standards, had something to recommend him in declining to kill people in wholesale lots. In the 2,500-year history of democracy since ancient Athens, a few politicians have arisen who more or less could be trusted with great powers, up to a point, briefly, in times of dire crisis, sort of. There were Washington, Lincoln, Churchill, and maybe somebody else, but I can't think who. We mustn't expect or desire a single politician who will extract us from our political difficulties. The semi-legendary Cincinnatus of 5th century BC Rome is often held up as a model politician. An impoverished farmer, though aristocratically born, Cincinnatus was twice given a dictatorship when Rome was in danger, and twice, when the danger had passed, promptly resigned the dictatorship and returned to his plowing. Our politicians should return to their plowing, usually of campaign aides. But Cincinnatus is also recalled as an opponent of the plebeians, us, and as a man who resisted enactment of a code of law applicable equally to plebeians and patricians. We shouldn't go looking for heroes in our politics, although finding an occasional decent man and sticking him into office is no bad thing. To give an example, A politician who I think is okay is John Sununu, my former New Hampshire senator and the son of previously quoted Governor Sununu. I think Sununu is okay, not because I agree with him on political issues, though I mostly do, but because of his political philosophy. For starters, he has one. "But it's not," he told me in an interview in 2008, "something I have written down on an index card." He then proceeded to give me a political philosophy that could be written down on an index card. "We are a free people who consented to be governed, not vice versa." If we want to fill the other side of the index card, Senator Sununu said, in most parts of the world, there never has been an appreciation for that perspective. Governments have evolved to provide greater freedom, to reduce the power of monarchies, to reduce absolute power. When they have evolved at all. I asked Senator Sununu if other politicians in Washington have political philosophies. "There are many," he said, "that would make the argument that they have a core set of values. But these values don't reflect a philosophy. Rather, they reflect a personal goal. I believe government should be fair and just. I believe government should represent both the strong and the weak in America. They're describing characteristics of what they'd like the government to be. They aren't describing principles of organizing a government." Did Senator Sununu have to compromise his principles to get elected? He said, "Voters are intelligent enough to understand that they can't agree with you about everything. What people want is someone who's thoughtful, direct, and able to explain. Reagan reveled in explaining. Was he too simplistic? He was as deep and thoughtful as any of his contemporaries." Senator Sununu didn't claim to be proud of being a politician. "I'm intrigued," he said, "by the notion that most of our country's founders were suspicious of anyone who wanted to hold public office, for example, Aaron Burr. The founders retained that suspicion even after they themselves held public office. They regarded it as an obligation, not an aspiration." Sununu had held office for a dozen years, first as a congressman, then as a senator. I asked, "Are you suspicious of yourself?" "When the New Hampshire House seat came open," he said, "I looked at the other people who had announced. I came to the conclusion that if I didn't run, New Hampshire would be represented by another trial lawyer." The Democrat who defeated John Sununu in 2008, former New Hampshire Governor Jean Shaheen, is not a trial lawyer. Her husband is. Shaheen is a product of the only institution capable of making our lives more miserable than the law courts. She was a schoolteacher. After the interview, Senator Sununu took me on a tour of the Capitol building. There are actually two domes atop the Capitol, one inside the other, and you can climb up in between them, 288 feet, to a little terrace at the feet of the heroic scale figure of freedom. The view seems to command the world. And sometimes American politics seems to try to do the same. This is not the best place to contemplate consent of the governed, but on the way up, we'd stopped at the balcony that surrounds the base of the inner dome. I looked at Constantino Brumidi's fresco, Apotheosis of Washington, painted in 1865. I wondered if the tourists in the Capitol Rotunda, 180 feet below, could see how fabulous the allegorical and mythological babes are who surround the father of our country and hover over the proceedings of our democracy. Armed freedom, Brumidi's beautiful wife was the model, triumphs over tyranny and kingly power. Enticing Ceres rides a mechanical wheat reaper, while nubile young America, wearing a liberty cap and little else, offers her encouragement. Alluring Aphrodite rises from the sea holding the Atlantic telegraph cable, and gorgeous Minerva imparts wisdom to Samuel Morse, Robert Fulton, and a frankly smitten Benjamin Franklin. The curvaceous arc at the apex of our national headquarters is covered in 4,664 square feet of rosy bosoms, shapely limbs, firm tummies, and concupiscent hips. We need to get closer to this. What has to change in America is our minds, and our politicians need to sit down and shut up, devote their energies to the kind of thoughts that Minerva has Ben Franklin thinking. Meanwhile, we should be cavorting with the nymphs of our freedoms and the equally attractive, in their mature way, personifications of our responsibilities, and not be asking favors from the tyranny and kingly power of politics. Governance can be party time, as it is on the Capitol ceiling, but it's BYOB. The power of politics is based on a fallacious understanding of rights. We have to give up all our ideas of positive rights, gimme rights. To get rid of our positive rights, we have to embrace our duties. The helpless and hapless don't have a right to our assistance, but we have absolute, inescapable, unalienable, if you will, duties to assist them. Why do we have these duties? If your conscience can't tell you, I sure can't. Even if the requirements of duty could be rationally explained, the elaborate logical justification for the necessity of duties would be blown to flinders by the thought of life in a world that didn't have them. What exactly are the duties that we have, and how much of them? The political process is one of the ways that we attempt to figure this out. We are married to our duties. There's no divorce. And whether we like it or not, politics will always be involved in the execution of our duties. We can be charitable to the point of self-abuse, and politics will still be involved. In a big country and a bigger world, our political system, our arrangement among persons, is such that those who need our help may be too distant in place or circumstance for us to know them the way we know our bum brother-in-law. Our fellow citizens may have to politically inform us of our duties, the way the abolitionists did in the 19th century. Along with our duties of the loving kind, we have less tender-hearted duties to keep our trash picked up, our fires fought, our miscreants arrested, and our criminal and civil courts operating. Annoying as the government's legal monopoly on deadly force can be, we really don't want to privatize it. We've seen privatization of deadly force, 9/11. We can desocialize some other aspects of government, but there are limits. It's hard to imagine the advantage of competing networks of private sewer pipes. Besides compassionate and quotidian duties, there are other responsibilities we need to accept. The adolescent ass who lives near me doesn't have a right to education. No such right exists. And personally, I don't feel much of a duty to educate this jerk who, while playing mailbox baseball by leaning out the passenger window of a buddy's car and swinging a Louisville slugger, knocked my U.S. mail receptacle for a triple. But using my money to provide the drip with as much education as he can contain may allow him to put his talents to better use in the future. I'll grant he has some. I myself, in 1964, leaning out the passenger window of a buddy's car and swinging a Louisville slugger, failed to remember that Mr. Norbert, next door, had put a cement block in his mailbox. Educating the young is not a matter of rights or duties, but it is a good idea, and it's our responsibility to occasionally have one. Either we embrace responsibilities, or they get turned over to the committee brain of politics. As I write, it's committee brain season in New Hampshire. Town meetings are held in March, as are the meetings of most school boards. There's nothing else to do this time of year. Nevertheless, few people in their right minds attend these gatherings. I guiltily confess we ought to. The result of the town meetings aren't too bad, probably because federal and state governments have usurped so much local authority that there isn't much bad left for town meetings to do. Examining the budgets of the town governments in my area, I see that annual expenditure averages about $900 per resident. That's not an exorbitant amount to keep our roads plowed and patched, our playground tetherball poles free from Americans with Disabilities Act violations, and our local malefactors under the eye of the law. Typical police log entry, as reported in the region's weekly newspaper, Monday, February 22nd, at 4 p.m., police received a report of a juvenile throwing rocks at people. Police spoke to the mother. No further action was required. The school boards are another matter. The proposed 2010 operating budget for my local school district is $43,698,819. The district has 3,151 students. That's $13,868 per student. The schools are good schools, as they should be for the price. Yet if we hugged our responsibilities tighter, we could gather these students into groups of 15. The district's high school has a teacher-student ratio of 1 to 15. Employ a tutor for each group and pay that tutor $200,000 a year. We could hire Aristotle. True, the kids wouldn't have band practice, but they'd have Aristotle. But if we really want to do something good for America, our best option is to get rich. Let's say we become a Wall Street financial whiz, making $10 million a year just churning derivatives. And let's say we try our best to cheat the IRS, too. We're still going to end up paying, what with income, capital gains, property, and sales taxes, a couple of million per annum into the public coffers. Let's say we do this for 20 years before we're arrested. That's $200 million worth of road repair, trash pickup, help to the disadvantaged, and lethal CIA drones. Now let's say we don't become a Wall Street financial whiz and join Earth First instead, and spend the next 20 years chained to a tree protesting something. For $200 million, we could have bought the damn forest. Whether we think politics is a bother or whether we are full of great expectations about all the good things politics tries to do, we have to scale back the scope of politics. Otherwise, no good things will be accomplished. We can't treat the American government like mom, expecting her to get us off to kindergarten in the morning, fix our meals, wash the dishes, fold the laundry, keep our house clean and our grandparents happy, do the shopping and the gardening, and still somehow make herself interesting to dad. That's why Mom snapped and started drinking and got in that car wreck. 6. All hands on deck. Of course, there's a lot of pent-up energy and aspirations in politics and politicians, and we do want to keep the political system busy and feeling fulfilled, lest politicians get loose in the neighborhood and do real harm. I think we should provide politics with an important mission, something that will allow politicians an outlet for their love of bombast and glory-seeking, that will get them outdoors and give them some exercise. Maybe the political system will slim down. My idea is pirates. For a breath of fresh air, there's nothing like the bounding main. The flap of canvas, the thunder of cannons, and the clang of bucklers being swashed will surely appeal to our over-imaginative politicos. And getting everyone in our government to fight pirates will also silence peevish critics of the political system like me. All mutinous impulses on a ship of state are quelled by the sighting of a hoisted Jolly Roger. We need pirates. And we're in luck. There's a whole country full of them ready at hand. Thank gosh for Somalia. In April 2009, when Captain Richard Phillips of the Maersk, Alabama, was rescued from Somali pirates by U.S. Navy SEALs, I hoped for a moment that the Obama administration would be completely distracted by pirates and forget the rest of its idiot ideas. Here was the first unblemished American military victory since 1991. And even in Kuwait, we stopped short and stood around pulling our mandate while Saddam Hussein slaughtered all resistance to his regime. The Gulf War had nothing like this neat, clean pop-pop-pop, with three wicked freebooters sent to Davy Jones's locker and another captured and hauled into the dock, there to face stern justice for brigandage upon the high seas. Admittedly, our bloodthirsty sea-dog prisoner, Abduwali Abdulkadir Musa, was notable mostly for sheepish grin, confused mien, and appearing to be about 12. Still, I don't think we gave President Obama enough kudos for his pirate-fighting triumph. We should have lit bonfires, set off fireworks, and crowned the president with laurel leaves, just to let him know that fighting pirates is the sort of thing that politicians should be doing. Fighting pirates is bipartisan. Fighting pirates is a consensus builder. Even the Democratic Party is not so inclusive that there's a pirate voting bloc that must be appeased. And if we have to gather all the 100-foot yachts once owned by AIG executives and now in possession of the Troubled Assets Recovery Program and send these to the Horn of Africa to lure the Somalis from their pirate lairs, so be it. What an improvement over the other challenges the political system faces. Pirates don't invest in hedge funds, credit swaps, or toxic mortgage debt. Major pirate financial institutions never collapse and require infusions of government funds, because pirates bury gold doubloons in treasure chests and leave us maps marked with an X so we can dig up the gold and replenish the Federal Reserve without recourse to painful tax increases. Plus, if pirates do want a bailout, just toss them a rusty bucket. Pirates have no need of healthcare reform. Eye patches, peg legs, and hooks are available over the counter at pharmacies, lumber yards, and hardware stores. Other pirate maladies may be treated by shaving their bellies with a rusty razor. Pirate retirement communities are nearby, within easy walking distance, and the planks are wheelchair accessible. Foreign policy is a moot point. Pirates are men without a country. Never mind that the country they're without is Somalia. "You call that a country?" is the expert assessment we will receive from those with knowledge of the region between Mogadishu and Djibouti. Those pirates don't have to be sent off to The Hague to be sentenced to 90 days for genocide. Time off for good behavior. The use of pirates for political purposes has a long and happy history. The young Julius Caesar, inexperienced and previously elected to only minor public office, made his mark in the Res Publica by killing pirates. They captured him on a voyage to Rhodes. Caesar told the pirates that as soon as he was ransomed, he would come back and slay every man-jack of them from captain to cabin boy. It will amaze modern politicians, but Caesar kept his campaign promise. Queen Elizabeth I, deft at courting public opinion, was hell on Spanish pirates when she wasn't busy financing English pirates such as Sir Francis Drake. Thomas Jefferson sent Stephen Decatur after the Barbary Coast pirates. It was a PR coup. The Marines are still going on about the shores of Tripoli. It worked out well for Decatur, too. There's a whole town in Illinois named after him, more than can be said for a certain former junior senator from that state. Our politicians should be warned, however, that the victory over the Barbary Coast pirates was frittered away in negotiations with the Bashaw of Tripoli. These were conducted by striped pants cookie pusher Tobias Lear, U.S. Consul General in Algiers. When Lear realized what a screw-up he was, he committed suicide, a protocol that may be worth reintroducing at the Clinton State Department. Therefore, President Obama must not be allowed, as is his wont, to talk to the pirates. Pirates get to open their mouths only to taste cold steel. Pirates could make for a turning point in American political life. Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of... Well, the Somali pirates are Muslims. Yo-ho-ho and a cheekful of cot. Johnny Depp is even now holed up in the Hollywood Hills, an actor prepares, getting ready to play the role of Abdulwali Abdulkadir Musay, lone survivor of the attempt to commandeer the Maersk, Alabama. And Disney's new Pirates of the Gulf of Aden attraction will be quite a thrill for the kiddies. There'll be live AK-47 fire and rocket-propelled grenade explosions, bales of cash from cowardly shipping companies and timorous European nations will fly in every direction. The ticket takers being hired are plainclothes Israeli security guards armed to the eyeballs. And at the end of the ride, an imam will jump out of the dark and scare the dickens out of the children with a harangue on Islamic fundamentalism. This imam is not to be confused with Iman, the supermodel, now Mrs. David Bowie, although she too is of Somali extraction. And here is another thing that will serve to distract politicians, Somali pirate lasses. Somalia, whatever its other deficiencies, is full of incredibly beautiful women. In Somalia, a girl like Iman is the girl that the hot girl brings with her to the cat shop so that the hot girl looks even hotter by comparison. Not that I'm implying our president would be interested in this sort of thing, unlike the previous Democratic president. Somali corsairs will grab the fancy of the political establishment and sidetrack the politically engaged from nosing around in our private business. Sunday morning public affairs TV show bookers, talk radio hosts, NPR reporters, and the like will be jamming satellite phone lines to Isle, Hafoun, Obeah, and other buccaneer redoubts trying to get Somalia's ocean marauders to change their names to something that's easier to pronounce, such as Blackbeard, Calico Jack, Long John Silver, or Johnny Depp. Everybody loves pirates. Do kids ever put on eye shades, pull out laptops, and pretend to be policy wonks? Did Robert Louis Stevenson write Tax Revenue Island? In Captain Blood, was Errol Flynn portraying an innocent hero forced to become a New Deal brain truster and team up with Works Progress Administration cutthroat Basil Rathbone? Does Jimmy Buffett sing A Liberal Looks at 40? I have an even better idea. Politicians, especially liberal politicians, could be pirates. They've already got some piratical ideas for the IRS. As a matter of fact, there was one pirate, a Captain Mission, who, according to the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, was unique in combining active piracy with socialistic ideals. He reigned for many years over a utopian republic in Madagascar. A good place for the bunch of them. Male liberals would have an excuse for wearing an earring. The liberal president could dump his stupid Portuguese water dog, talk about a name for a bad pirate movie, and get a parrot that sits on his shoulder. Every time Glenn Beck comes on TV, the parrot would squawk, "Voices of hate! Voices of hate!" Politicians could work the pirate angle a lot of different ways. It's not like just being a politician where you're pretty much locked into one plot line. You become popular, you become unpopular, you become a lobbyist. Piracy is more flexible. Politicians could fly away to J.M. Barrie's Neverland, where good triumphs and evil gets eaten by a crocodile. Barack Obama is Peter Pan. Dick Cheney is Captain Hook. Eric Holder is a ticking reptile. Or politicians could play it for laughs and steal the script from Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance. The operetta ends with a daytime television-like scene, an Oprah-etta, where it turns out that the privateers are actually well-educated people from prosperous backgrounds, but they have issues, like Nancy Pelosi. In fact, the part of Ruth, a piratical maid of all work, is perfect for Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, "One moment, let me tell you who they are. They are no members of the common throng. They are all congressmen who have gone wrong." I've rewritten the libretto slightly with Harry Reid in place of the Pirate King. President Obama. "No American can hear this and not make amends, because with all our faults we love our congressmen. I pray you pardon me, ex-Senator Reid. Polls will be polls, and hacks do have their needs. Resume your ranks and legislative duties, and take my daughters, all of whom are beauties." The president will want to cut that last line, but it will be a great show. Best of all, we'll get to hear Obama sing, "I am the very model of a democratic president, with plenty of ideas, vague, expensive, and irrelevant. What I'm saying may be nonsense, but I'm saying it emphatical. What I'm saying may be lousy, but pretend it is pragmatical." The locusts have no king, yet they go forth. Proverbs 30:27. Acknowledgements. The title belongs to the great American political consultant, campaign strategist, advance man, and political prankster, Dick Tuck. More than 30 years ago, Dick told me that "don't vote, it just encourages the bastards" was a favorite saying of his mother. Dick Tuck was the nemesis of Dick Nixon. At the first Nixon-Kennedy debate, Tuck hired an old lady to get in front of the TV cameras wearing a Nixon button and throw her arms around the sweaty candidate who thought he'd bested his young opponent. "Don't worry, son," the old lady said loudly. "He beat you now, but you'll get in next time." Tuck did some of his best work for the Kennedys, in particular the most estimable of them, Robert. "Dick, I apologize for any harsh words about my fellow bog-trotters. Although Tuck and I are politically an aisle apart, I've never had a partisan argument with him." Who could argue with the nemesis of Dick Nixon? Along with some jokes, this book is a work of political theory. As such, it is not too original, and I mean that in a good way. Nothing is worse than a too original political theory, except perhaps a too original cookbook. Bring water to a boil and immerse live pythons. To call an artist derivative is an insult. To call a political theorist derivative is to admit that he or she has paid some attention to the eon of human political activity from which political theory derives. Any reader who notices my use of the phrase, "politics is an arrangement among persons," or my use of the phrase, "it's not a thinking man's game," may suspect that "Don't Vote" is a gloss or a glib exposition upon Michael Oakeshott's 1947 essay, "Rationalism in Politics." And that's true. Or I think maybe it's true. 20 years of intermittent efforts were required for me to push my way through the prose brambles of Oakeshott's thesis. What you read here may be a passage of thought, or it may be a record of scratched mental tissue and torn ideological clothing resulting from an attempt to follow in Oakeshott's footsteps. There are other writings that should be consulted for smarter versions of what I've written. Novus Ordo Seclorum, The Intellectual Origins of the Constitution, by Forrest MacDonald, delivers what it promises it will. Adam Smith's The Theory of Moral Sentiments was the best work, and still is, of moral philosophy available as the moral philosophy of America was being formed. MacDonald believes that the theory of moral sentiments and the wealth of nations were the dominant flavorings to the broth of intellect in which America's founders stewed. A silly metaphor, but one of the pleasures an author takes in writing acknowledgments is knowing that they go to press lightly edited. Thomas Paine is a political theorist whom I love for his sheer irksomeness to authority. All there really is to say about the politics of liberty is contained in Paine's dictum, "Man has no property in man." But I have a crumbling old collection of Paine's work, cover price 50 cents, where, in a windy introduction by John Dos Passos, Paine's limitations are inadvertently pointed out. Dos Passos damns Paine by praising his faith in man's unaided reason. A fellow hated by both the King of England and Robespierre, and distrusted by John Adams. Surely there was more to Paine than that. Thomas Paine, by Craig Nelson, and Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, by Christopher Hitchens, gave me a better understanding of one Tom, and Hitchens's Thomas Jefferson, author of America, shed light on the complications of another. That book also ends with a splendid line of Christopher's, which I meant to find a place for in this book. Here will have to suffice. History is a tragedy and not a morality tale. While randomly pulling books from my reference shelf to look up some small historical matter, I made the happy find of Hugh Brogan's The Penguin History of the United States of America. My copy was published in England in 1990, and I seem to have owned but not consulted it for a score of years. Brogan turns out to have a discerning eye for the manifold threads of populism in American politics. I thank him for an improved comprehension of Jacksonian Democrats, radical Republicans, Greenbackers, and progressives. As to populism, I was holding forth in a lecture hall not long ago, and in answer to a question about the Tea Party movement, I said, "At least they aren't demanding any further positive rights from government. Name me another American populist group that hasn't demanded new positive rights." A voice from the crowd called out, "The Whiskey Rebellion." Point taken. For the concept of positive and negative rights, I, and all the rest of us, owe gratitude to Isaiah Berlin and his 1959 book, Two Concepts of Liberty. When I'm faced with political economy conundrums, and political economy seems to contain nothing else, I fall back on a few works filled with common sense. The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich Hayek, Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman, and Free to Choose by Milton and Rose Friedman. These books are moral as well as material guides. Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College, once had an argument with Milton Friedman on this point. It went something like this. Arn: "Free to Choose is a deeply moral book." Friedman: "Free to Choose is a book of practical economics." Arn: "It's a moral book." Friedman: "It's a practical book." Arn: "It's a moral book." Friedman: "I wrote it and I say it's a book of practical economics." Arn: "Once you write it, it isn't yours anymore. I read it and I say it's a moral book." When I become confused by economic theory, and is there any other way to be, I turn to New Ideas from Dead Economists by Todd Buchholz. He quickly and cogently explains the ideas of dead economists and tells us why to hope that most of them stay dead. Then there is a book that provides a negative lesson. Much as I admire the stylings of H.L. Mencken, it is his worst work, Notes on Democracy, that I find inspiring. Notes was published in 1926 and is an extended bitch on the subject. All Mencken can manage by way of complimenting democracy is to ask, is it inordinately wasteful, extravagant, dishonest? Then so is every other form of government. All alike are enemies to laborious and virtuous men. That's crap. Witness mankind's experiences with every other form of government. Witness the alternatives to democracy on offer the very year Notes came out. Russia's communism, Italy's fascism, the whiff of mob rule in Britain's general strike. One more writer upon whom I've relied heavily, though he's neither profound nor consistent, is me. Writing about politics after an adulthood spent writing about politics would be impossible without a certain amount of self-plagiarism. Some phrases, sentences, and the occasional paragraph from my previous books reappear in this one. In Parliament of Whores, All the Trouble in the World, Eat the Rich, and On the Wealth of Nations, I tried, in different contexts, to think through some of the same problems I've tried to think through here. Sometimes you say things as well as you can, and when it's time to say the same thing, the person you end up quoting is you. He must be a poor creature who does not often repeat himself, said Oliver Wendell Holmes. Imagine the author of the excellent piece of advice, Know Thyself, never alluding to that sentiment again. And I've used that before, too, in The CEO of the Sofa. Only once, however, do I lift a long passage from a volume of my own. In 1993, I wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal saying what I thought of Hillary Clinton's health care reform proposal. I included this in a 1995 collection, Age and Guile. As a testimony to the circles, per Dante's Inferno, that politics run around in, I changed one name and a couple of numbers, and this was what I thought of Barack Obama's health care reform proposal. Besides cribs from my books, at least 27 essays and speeches written over the past 15 years have served as rough drafts for parts of Don't Vote. I am very grateful to the Weekly Standard, where I've had a happy home since it was founded in 1995. I thank everyone on its staff, from William Crystal and Fred Barnes at the top of the masthead, to the most temporary of interns who politely pretend to know who I am when I phone the office. It is a pleasure working with all of you. And for adding ideas to my head and subtracting solecisms from my prose, I give specific thanks to Deputy Editor Richard Starr, Literary Editor Philip Terzian, Managing Editor Claudia Anderson, and my oldest friend in Washington, Senior Editor Andrew Ferguson. I also had ample opportunities to talk, think, and write about politics at The Atlantic, under the editorship of Cullen Murphy, and before that under the editorship of the late and much-missed Michael Kelly. The chapter Why I'm Right appeared in the book Why I Turned Right, edited by the brilliant Mary Eberstadt, mother of my goddaughter, Alexandra. The End of the American Automobile Industry chapter I owe to an assignment from the Wall Street Journal. Jim Denton, my other oldest friend in Washington and the publisher of World Affairs, encouraged me to plunge into the morass of foreign policy. Additional articles from which I've drawn material appeared in Forbes, the Financial Times, and, of all places, Rolling Stone, where for some reason Bill Grider and I were allowed to conduct a months-long left-versus-right debate in print, doubtless to the utter mystification of the Rolling Stone target demographic. Bill's a great guy. Wrong about everything, but a great guy. For almost 30 years I've been working with, well, he's done all the working, Don Epstein at the Greater Talent Network Lecture Agency. Through the kind and diligent efforts of Don and everyone at GTN, I've had the opportunity to try out various political ideas and opinions on lecture audiences around the country. No audience members were harmed in these experiments, as far as I know. When the idea for this book was larval, Larry Arn listened attentively to my description of the grub. Greg Lindsay, executive director of the Center for Independent Study, invited me and my family to Australia and New Zealand in 2009. There, Greg and his family showed us splendid hospitality. Greg, Tina is still Googling how to remove red wine stains from white lamb's wool rugs. The talks that I gave in Sydney, Canberra, Perth, and Wellington would, through no fault of Greg's, evolve into the opening chapters of Don't Vote. Thanks also to John Green and his family for making our Antipodean journeys so excellent, for everything except white lamb's wool rugs. The Cato Institute, that most thoughtful of Washington think tanks, has been providing me with research support, not to mention the moral kind, since the 1980s. There is no one working at Cato who hasn't, in some way, helped form my political ideas. To name a very few of them, Executive Vice President David Boaz, especially for his book Libertarianism, A Primer, and for his editorship of The Libertarian Reader. Tom Palmer and Roger Pilone for their knowledge and understanding of constitutionalism. Peter Van Doren, editor of Cato's invaluable anti-regulatory regulation magazine. Jerry Taylor, who knows everything about resources and the squandering of them, which government is so good at. Michael Tanner, Michael F. Cannon, and Aaron Yelovitz, without whose mastery of facts and figures, I could not have written the healthcare chapter. And, of course, Ed Crane, Cato's president for life, who has bestowed upon me the title of Mencken Research Fellow at Cato. I'm honored, even though I'm pretty sure Ed has read Mencken's Notes on Democracy. Max Pappas was my assistant a decade ago and has done well anyway. He now occupies the post of Vice President, Public Policy at FreedomWorks. Max researched the origins of modern terrorism, and I apologize for taking 10 years to put his research to use. It was also Max who walked me through the blind alleys of ratiocination behind campaign finance reform, and who explained to me what the hell the recent Supreme Court ruling on the subject was all about. Richard Pipes, the preeminent historian of Russia and the Russian Revolution, is a good friend and also a great teacher about the process by which reform turns to radicalism and radicalism turns to riot. I am deeply in debt to his book Property and Freedom, the most powerful argument for linking these social goods since Adam Smith's. It was Charlie Glass who more than a quarter century ago showed me through the ruins of Lebanon and let me see that when we call the American political system highly polarized, chaotic, and corrupt, we are full of shit. Charlie and I don't usually agree about politics, but it is my hope that he'll be able to get through at least a few chapters of this book before he writes to tell me that I remain a right-wing nut. Jay Winnick confirmed my hunch that Alexander Hamilton never recanted his objections to the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. But, wrote Jay, I also strongly suspect that, like most of the other founders, he made peace with the Bill of Rights. Nick Eberstadt provided me with, among many other things, an educated guess at the body count from Mao's Let 100 Flowers Bloom pogrom. Kudos to Neil Hudley for rediscovering Milton Friedman's radio interviews from the Paleolithic 1970s era of media. Tim Bainey pointed out the number of gun murders, none in North Dakota, a state with notoriously lax gun control laws. Ed Mallon and Des Desvernine are doing important ongoing undercover work, therefore I cannot name them publicly. Candles for Men, Mandels, was the idea of Alex Vogel. The complete range of scents available as soon as Alex gets his startup capital, beer, cigars, old dog, spilled bourbon, gear oil, pool hall, frying meat, grass clippings, charcoal smoke, chainsaw exhaust, canvas tarpaulin, and trout. Michael Gewurz had the savvy notion for marketing home colonoscopy kits. Motorized cup holders is a quip I stole from Lee Bass. Lee will know what I mean when I say, after finishing this book, I need to sit down for a moment and sort things out. I swiped the line about Japan, sticking its economy where the rising sun never shines, from my old friend Dave Garcia in Hong Kong. James A. Weiner, Foreign Service Officer retired, provided me with a joke that will go unspecified. My assistant, Phoebe Bunker, spent many long hours digging up obscure and abstruse research material for this book. She also spent many more and much longer hours inputting and outputting, and, for all I know, shot-putting the manuscript, because I don't even know which end of a computer to stick the 8-track cassette into. Phoebe, you were very good-natured about it all. The dust cover photo was shot with style and flair by James Kegley, who is not to be blamed for his subject's looks, or attire, that being the author's idea on the theory that the only real benefit of being over 60 is a perfect freedom to injure one's own dignity, to the extent that time hasn't done the job already. The author would look even more frightful if it hadn't been for the ministrations of stylist Janice Heffron and of photographer's assistant Mike Stargill, who kept moving the lights around in an attempt to keep the cover photo from looking like a portrait of Uncle Samosaurus. At the behest of my excellent friend Frank Saul, Washington's Hay Adams Hotel lent us a room for the photo shoot. Jenny Neeson made us comfortable there, for which we thank her. You should stay at the Hay Adams, even if you live in Washington already. It's so close to the White House that you can see the president sneak a smoke, but not so close that he can lecture you on health care reform and financial regulation. Grove Atlantic has remained a patient and understanding publisher. Chief Executive Morgan Entrekin, with whom my friendship dates back to the 1970s, has published all but one of my books, and he reissued that one. Thank you, Morgan, and thank you, Eric Price, for keeping Grove Atlantic functioning, Charles Rue Woods for keeping it looking good, Deb Seeger and Scott Manning for keeping it publicized, Don Kennison for unmangling my spelling and grammar, Managing Editor Michael Hornberg for managing, Sue Cole for making sure somebody remembered to send the book to the printer, and to Andrew Robinson and every other Grove Atlantic literary light. And lastly, I want to thank my wife, Tina, for 15 years of happiness, which is none of the reader's business. More to the point, I want to thank her for the editorial targeting she did on Don't Vote. Tina undertook a careful re-aiming of my 12-gauge open-bore scattershot approach to my subject. She convinced me to use full choke in both barrels on politics. I've got a bead on the thing now, honey, and I promise I won't ask you to clean or cook it. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Don't Vote, It Just Encourages the Bastards, by P.J. O'Rourke. Copyright 2010 by P.J. O'Rourke. Performed by Christopher Lane. Directed by Kevin Yon. Engineered by Stephen Jacoby. Performance copyright 2010 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.